speaker is Dr. William Propa from the program in human biology at Stanford University. And he's going to talk to us about stem cells, embryos, and ethics. Your way forward.
Can we turn the lights?
I don't know about Jared Seichel, but what about Elvis? So what I want to do, as the author of the proposal that Rudy talked about this morning, altered nuclear transfer, I also serve on the President's Council on Bioethics, so I want to lay out a little bit of what I see as the social and political context of this discussion. Then I want to describe what I understand to be the core of the ethical question, and in essence I'm going to say that it relates to the living human organism. And then I want to explain the ethics behind what Rudy talked about this morning. In other words, I want to try to explain why what altered nuclear transfer creates is not reasonably called a living human organism, therefore should suffice for the way forward with embryonic stem cell research, what the President's Council has changed to the term pluripotent when not derived from an embryo. Pluripotent and embryonic stem cells are the same in this discussion. So I think we have to acknowledge we're at a crucial moment in the process of scientific discovery. The dramatic advances in molecular biology throughout the 20th century have culminated in sequencing of the human genome onto proteomics, increased knowledge of cell physiology and cytology. These advances were accomplished largely by breaking down organic systems into their component parts. Now, however, as we move on to developmental biology, we've returned to the study of living beings. When applied to human biology, this, of course, reopens the most fundamental questions concerning the relationship between the material form and the moral meaning of developing life. The current controversy over embryonic stem cell research is the first of quite a series of difficult controversies that will no doubt emerge: human-animal chimeras, parthenogenesis projects involving the laboratory, creation of organs, and so forth. There will be a wide range of projects, and they will continue to challenge our definitions of human life. And clearly, they're not just questions for empirical science. They require the full breadth of human wisdom and experience. The scientific arguments for going forward with this research are strong, I would say compelling. Yet from the moral perspective, there are serious concerns. This is an 8-cell embryo, by the way, on the sharp tip of the pin. Very small indeed. It's important to acknowledge the many scientific projects for which human embryonic stem cells, or human embryos, in fact, could be used. Beyond the destruction for the procurement of embryonic stem cells, some fear the industrial-scale production of living human embryos for a wide range of research involving natural development, toxicology, drug studies, and so forth. So embryonic stem cells serve as a symbolic stand-in for a much larger discussion. I talked with Lord Alton, a member of the United Kingdom's House of Lords, and he told me that they estimate that in the UK they've already used between 200,000 and 300,000 human embryos in scientific experimentation. So this is an important issue, and that's obviously just the beginning. And then beyond the concern for embryos, Rudy mentioned this morning their concerns about the commodification of eggs, how you procure them. Some people are worried about the implications of ongoing research to develop artificial endometria, a kind of artificial womb that allow extracorporeal gestation of human embryos to later stages to procure more advanced cells, tissues, and organs. And then, of course, from a social perspective, do we really want to have red state medicine, blue state medicine? Do we really want to have the emerging patchwork of policies on the state level, which threatens to create situations where what's happening in one state is different from another, and in any case, where a large number of patients will enter the hospital with either resentment that they're not getting the treatments they think they could have had, or moral qualms about the research practices on which their cures are built. In other words, there's a compelling case for finding a way forward. What was traditionally the sanctuary of compassionate care at the most vulnerable and sensitive moments of human life, namely the hospital medical setting, is now tragically becoming an arena of controversy and conflict. Both sides of this difficult debate clearly are defending important human goods, and goods that are important to all of us. A purely political solution will leave our country bitterly divided, If you don't believe that, you should have been in Washington last week. This, in turn, this division is eroding social support and our sense of noble purpose that is essential for the public funding of biomedical science. While there are currently no federally legislated constraints on the private use of embryonic stem cells and their derivation in research, there is consensus among leading scientists that without NIH support for newly created embryonic stem cell lines, progress in this important realm of research will be severely constrained. The current conflict in the political arena is damaging to science, I believe it's damaging to religion, and to our larger sense of national unity. The way this debate is proceeding is, in my opinion, completely contrary to the positive pluralism that's the strength of our democracy. What we need to do is draw back from our entrenched positions and ask ourselves, isn't it possible if we talk in an intelligent and accepted manner that we can find a way forward that respected the concerns of everybody and the desires of everybody? So in order to discuss that, first I want to lay out what would be the criteria that could go forward and satisfy those concerns, the moral issue of the instrumental use of human life. Any evaluation of the moral significance of human life must take into account the full perception of continuity and change that's essential for its development. With the act of conception, a new life is initiated with a distinct genetic endowment that organizes and guides the growth of a unique and unrepeatable human being. The gametes, the sperm and the egg, although alive as cells, are not living beings. They are instrumental organic agents of the parents. The joining of the gametes brings into existence an entirely different kind of entity, a living human organism. With regard to fundamental biological meaning and moral significance, the act of fertilization is a leap from zero to everything. In both structure and function, the zygote, the one-cell embryo, and subsequent embryonic stages differ from all other cells or tissues of the body. They contain within themselves the organizing principle for the full development of the human being. The very word organism implies organization, an overarching principle that binds the parts and processes of life into a harmonious whole. As a living being, an organism is an integrated, self-developing, and self-maintaining unity under the governance of an immanent plan. For an embryonic organism, this implies an inherent potency, an engaged and effective potential with a drive in the direction of the mature form. By the very nature, an embryo is a developing being. That's what an embryo is. Its wholeness is defined by both its manifest expression and its latent potential. It is the phase of human life in which the whole, as the unified organismal principle of growth, precedes and produces the parts. The philosopher Robert Joyce explains, living beings come into existence all at once and then gradually unfold to themselves and to the world what they already but only incipiently are. To be a human organism is to be a whole living member of the species Homo sapiens, with a human present and a human future evident in the intrinsic potential for the manifestation of the species' typical form. Joyce continues, no living being can become anything other than what it already essentially is. It is this implicit whole with its inherent potency that endows the embryo with continuity of human identity from the moment of conception and onward, and therefore from this perspective, its inviolable moral nature. To interfere in its development is to transgress upon a life in process. The principle of this analysis would apply to any entity that has the same potency and potential as a human embryo produced by natural fertilization. So whether it's by IVF cloning or some other process, when it has this nature, this potential, it has moral standing by this perspective. So with respect to fundamental moral status, the human being is an embodied being whose intrinsic dignity is inseparable from its full procession of life and always present in its varied stages of emergence. This conclusion is consistent with 2,500 years of medical science. As recently as 1948, the physician's oath in the Declaration of Geneva, echoing the enduring traditions of Hippocratic medicine, proclaimed, "I will maintain the utmost respect for human life from the time of conception." So we have to be very careful with our medical science as we descend into an instrumental use of human life. If we do that, we may end up destroying the very reasons we are undertaking our new therapies. We may degrade the very humanity we're trying to heal. So in light of these arguments, if this is the way it is there a way forward? If embryonic stem cells can be derived only from human embryos, I don't think there is a way forward. But I believe there are possibilities. These possibilities were laid out in a white paper by the President's Council of Michigan. And one of those proposals was altered nuclear transfer. The white paper is worth reading for all the proposals, but since I'm the author of this one, I'll describe it and use it as an example of how to go forward. So, as described in the above analysis, natural conception signals the activation of the organizing principle for the self-development and self-maintenance of a full human organism. In the language of stem cell biology, this capability is termed totipotency, the capacity to form the full human organism. A naturally fertilized egg, of course, is totipotent. In contrast, pluripotency designates the capacity to produce all of the cell types of the human body, but not the coherent and integrated unity of a living being. Embryonic stem cells are merely pluripotent. This is the difference between the material parts and the living whole. Altered nuclear transfer would draw on the basic techniques of somatic cell nuclear transfer, oddly known as therapeutic cloning, but with an alteration such that pluripotent stem cells are produced without the creation and destruction of totipotent human embryos. Now, Rudy went through this morning, but just quickly, natural fertilization combines the essential elements into the zygote. Somatic cell nuclear transfer does sort of the same thing, but it uses the nucleus of an adult cell, reprograms it, and gets, at least in theory, an embryo in certain small number of cases. That's how Dolly the sheep came to be. If Dolly was a sheep, Dolly was once an embryo. Altered nuclear transfer would take the edge off the probability concerns that Rudy was mentioning this morning, such that you would always never get an embryo. Instead, you would alter the genetics in such a way that what was transferred to nuclear transfer would be incapable of forming the integrated organism, but would form what is essentially biologically and morally the equivalent of a tissue culture. So there's a natural precedent for such a project. In natural conception, fertilization signals the activation of the organizing principle for the self-development of the full human organism. But without all the essential elements, the necessary complement of chromosomes, proper epigenetic configuration, and cytoplasmic factors for gene expression, there can be no living whole, no organism, and no human embryo. Recent scientific evidence suggests incomplete combinations of the necessary elements, some what you might call failures of fertilization, are the fate of many, perhaps most, early natural initiations in reproduction. That's in natural reproduction. It's important to realize that many of these naturally occurring failures of fertilization may still proceed along partial trajectories of organic growth without being actual organisms. For example, certain grossly abnormal karyotypes, including haploid genomes, that's only half of the natural number of chromosomes, they will still form a blastocyst structure in some cases, but they will not implant. Even an egg without a nucleus, when artificially activated, has the developmental power to divide to the 8-cell stage, yet clearly is not an embryo or not even an organism at all. In this case, the messenger RNA for the protein synthesis that drives these early cell divisions is generated during the maturation of the egg and then activated after fertilization or without fertilization, just by activation. So like a spinning top, the cells of an activated egg, they contain certain biological momentum that tells them on the partial trajectory of development, but unlike the normal embryo, they're unable to kind of bootstrap themselves into becoming an integrated and self-regulating organism. Some of these aberrant products of fertilization that lack the qualities and characteristics of an organism appear actually capable of producing embryonic stem cells or their functional equivalent. Mature teratomas are benign tumors that generate all three primary embryonic cell types, as well as more advanced cells, tissues, and organs. And in this case, you can see those opacities in the x-ray there. Those are actually fully formed teeth inside of the ovary of a woman. Well, it's a very interesting natural example of what I'm trying to do with alternate nuclear transfer on a much smaller scale, of course, a much more fundamental scale. Clearly, these chaotic, disorganized, and non-functional masses, which are like a bag of jumbled puzzle parts, they're not organisms, they lack entirely the structural and dynamic character of organisms. Clearly, these are not what either the religious tradition or the medical traditions have ever considered the locus of moral concern. The disorganized character of teratomas appears to arise not from changes in the DNA sequence, they are full diploid entities, but from genetic imprinting and epigenetic modification that affects the pattern of gene expression during gametogenesis. In natural reproduction, the sperm and the egg have different but complementary patterns of imprinting, allowing a coordinated control of embryonic development. When an egg is activated without a sperm, the trophectoderm, the outer layer that Rudy described this morning, will not form properly, but the embryo proper, or the inner portion, will form. In the absence of the complementary genetic contribution male, the activated egg is simply incapable, inadequately constituted in the first place to direct the integrated development characteristic of human embryogenesis. And this example points to another, oh, I'm so sad this didn't come out. It was a big network of interacting molecules. Okay, get the point. Systems biology. It's amazing the AV demons always get in the way here when you want to make your points. The point is, systems biology is a fantastic window into what we've always sort of implicitly known. Through systems biology, you're beginning to recognize how even a small change in one gene can affect the entire balance of an enormous network of biochemical processes. It's not like you take out one gene and you've taken out 1% of its organismal existence. You take out essentially a component that's essential for the whole function. So, yet there are, at the same time, systems biology has made this part clear, there are subsets of development that will proceed, even though it's not an organism. Systems biology offers us a view of an organism as a dynamic whole, an interactive web of interdependent processes that express emergent properties not apparent in the parts. Within this dynamic, self-sustaining system is the very principle of life when properly constituted. There, it has the organizing information and coordinated coherence that characterize a living being. With the full complement of coordinated parts, an organismal system subsumes and sustains the parts. It exerts a downward causation that binds and balances the parts into a patterned program of integrated growth and development. Partial organic subsystems, however, incomplete, if separated or created separately from the organism, may proceed forward with a degree of momentum of organic growth, but without the coherent coordination and robust self-regulation of the full organism, they simply can't sustain themselves. So they're not reasonably called organisms in the first place. They're just disorganized growth or partially organized growth. Altered nuclear transfer proposes a small but precisely selected alteration that will allow the harnessing partial developmental trajectories, apart from their full natural context, in order to harness a subset that will produce embryonic stem cells. Now, altered nuclear transfer is a broad concept, and CDX2, the gene that Rudy mentioned this morning, was the gene that I suggested when I first proposed it, and it looks actually like a pretty good candidate, but there really are many possible ways. It's easy to make something not to work, but it has to work well enough to get embryonic stem cells. So it turns out to be quite an interesting gene selection. So as Rudy described earlier, he can either knock down or knock out the genetics of CDX2. And it turns out, in recent work within the last 6 months, it turns out that CDX2 is already present as a maternal transcript in the egg before fertilization, and it's asymmetrically distributed in the zygote, and during the first cell division, it's asymmetrically distributed to one of the two blastomeres. And now there's evidence, at least in certain strains of mice, that the one that inherits most of the CDX2 goes on to form the trophectoderm lineage, the outer layer, but the other one goes on to form what we're interested in, the inner cell mass. And with SCMT, you would theoretically get that same
same proper distribution. However, with altered nuclear transfer, if you combine what Rudy described this morning, short hairpin RNA silencing to preclude later expression of the gene, if you combine that with injection of segments of short interfering RNA, you can actually knock out the CDX2 maternal transcripts, and what you get is truly just a tissue culture of a single cell lineage. You don't get an integrated organism at all. You get basically something that has just one cell type. It's the moral equivalent of, if you will, one voice trying to sing a duet. It's just not capable of doing it. It's like one hand trying to clap. Lacking one of the two essential cell types, it just can't develop as an integrated being. So, what are the possibilities here? What use could we make of all this? Well, unfortunately, I took out some crucial points I wanted to make. Let me just make these points. Okay. Just want to make these points. Now, some people have raised the issue of, well, have you created a disabled embryo or a deficient embryo? Well, that's a very strange kind of question. I mean, I think by its very nature, an embryo must have a capacity to develop. That's what defines it. But I think this is such a clear case of starting not with something that results in a deficiency in a being, but with components that are insufficient to even constitute the being in the first place. And that's why I think it's a moral project and not a disabled entity at all. It's important to realize the significance of this project, because as wonderful as it would be if we could reprogram adult cells directly back to the state of the ESL, that would give us no tool to study the first 4 or 5 days, at least in NIH terms. This altered nuclear transfer would allow you an entity, a kind of a system of standardized production with which you could continue to knock things out, alter further things, and probe what's necessary, for example, for the production of ES cells. So it creates a flexible tool for significant experiments. It would allow you to produce genome-specific cell types, ES cells, as with cloning, that were theoretically designed to correspond to a patient's immune status, maybe to study their disease, or perhaps even as cell therapies. It would distance this whole project from clinical medicine, which I think is a very good and important goal, and it would allow this to go forward as really a laboratory procedure. And in the process, altered nuclear transfer would probably supply information that would help in the project of reprogramming. So it's a pretty hopeful project in the sense that it's both morally reasonable and scientifically feasible and would open a lot of positive possibilities. The one remaining link that is a problem, of course, is the procurement of eggs, but I think it's pretty reasonable to think we will find more sources of eggs. I can talk about that as we discuss questions. Let me make just one final comment about this. I think G.K. Chesterton had a wonderful little model. He said, the metaphor, he said, little boys are playing soccer in a field, but right at the edges of the field, the cliffs go down 1,000 feet to the waves crashing below it. So where are they playing soccer? Only in the middle 20 yards. And then somebody comes and builds a fence at the edge. In other words, they define clearly and precisely where the danger is. Now they can play to the very edges. And I think that's what we need to do. And I think especially those of us in this community that consider ourselves as Christians, we need to take a role in this. We need to say, what is the moral concern exactly? So that we don't burden science with too much constraint and help science see the point of the moral concerns that we hold to be true. And of course, we're participants in a larger dialogue, and we have to have the humility of listening very well to others. But I believe there are ways we can all agree and can all go forward. And I think it's a crucial project. My own feeling is there's organismal continuity from the initiation of life to its natural death. I think we are a mysterious creature unfolding, like all creatures, but in our own human way, unfolding, starting from nothing and opening ourselves forward. Pascal, 350 years ago, noted that human existence is located between infinities, between the infinitely large and the infinitely small. He went on to say, by size, the universe surrounds and swallows me up like a dot. By thought, I encompass the universe. Well, what kind of a thought could encompass the universe? You could say to yourself, well, look, it's a very small thing to use an embryo. But it is true that that is the initiation point of a human life. And it seems to me there is something that is important in this. It's true that from here you can't see, barely see, the embryo. But it's also true that from here you can't see the people. Here you can't see the Earth. Here you can't even see our galaxy. So we're located between infinities, and yet by size the universe encompasses and swallows up like a dot. By thought, encompass the universe. But what thought could encompass the universe? I would suggest that thought might be love, a kind of positive nourishment, a kind of seeking for positive answers. C.S. Lewis said we should answer all of our problems with more love, not less love. Seems to me a project like this seeks that out. After all, each one of us, at this tiny stage of our existence, was conduited who we are now, and fortunately we reach given the protection and nurture necessary for the fullness of our expressed being. In the dawn of our lives, we receive that love. We should bear in mind what John of the Cross said, that in the evening of life, we will all be judged by love. Thank you.
Thank you for that very thought-provoking talk. Are there any questions, Dr. Hogan?
Francis.
So, we talked this morning in Rudy's presentation about the possibility of identifying what the components are of the oocyte that allow the differentiated cell to de-differentiate. And I'd be curious to know your thoughts on how that plays out in terms of moral status. If we get to the point where any differentiated cell, a skin cell for instance, if put in the presence of the appropriate number of growth factors and RNAis, has the potential then of erasing its particular epigenetic marks and becoming, in the same way that we now use an oocyte, the equivalent of an embryo. This is obviously not something that happens in nature. At what point along that pathway does moral status attach, given that we no longer are talking about the inclusion of something as precious as an oocyte, we're talking about basically some biochemistry here.
Yeah.
How does that change the argument?
Well, the fact that it's biochemistry doesn't change the argument, because I happen to think you and I are biochemistry, right? So it's the configuration of the biochemistry that counts. And I would say this, if you're going to solve this problem in a way that will meet the demands or the concerns of the vast tract of America of all the spectrum of beliefs, I think you have to get to the point where you create an entity that doesn't have the totipotency, regardless of how it got there. And I think we should be able to reprogram cells backwards, hopefully, to the point where they aren't totipotent beings, but are pluripotent. In other words, take them right back down to the edge. And I know you could say, well, that's just one or two molecules more, but that's the difference between being alive and dead as a living being. And I think that if you're going to solve this problem, you need to do that. I think once you've got an entity which, when implanted into a womb, could grow, that will be a moral concern to a large number of people, and regardless of how you made it. I understand the laboratory creation makes it a very weird question. But
yeah, because in a certain sense, at that point, the genome is totipotent. And our cells all have a genome, and you get to the point where you begin to wonder, wait a minute, are we attaching sacredness to virtually every cell that on its own we didn't think of in those terms?
Well, no, that's the difference between what you might call an active potency and a passive potency. Every cell has a passive potential to be converted to a zygote, perhaps, but it isn't in its natural state inclined that way. What the difference is, once you've added the components that make it an active potency for the development of a living human being, then you've changed its ontologic state, its moral standing. And that at least that's the way you would have to answer this to meet the critics as a whole. I don't think that's too odd, because after all, what is the difference between what we would create with alternate nuclear transfer or a failure of fertilization or a teratoma? And what's the difference between a teratoma and a living embryo? Well, it's maybe a few molecules of some sort, but it is a difference. It's a crucial difference in the potential of the thing.
I think the goal of reprogramming homozygotes to be every expense on itself is not to create an end. I think it's always impossible. So that if you arrive at every expense on itself, that's not what we do. It can never be done. And I don't think reprogramming can even achieve that. I think that's impossible. You can make X from yes, but that's a different way of doing it. Yes, maybe you can do this a lot, but you cannot make. So I think you're concerned that you could generate something which would then, any ethical concern, could possibly make it more meaningful.
No, that exists.
Scientifically, you don't. I know this, I didn't mean it.
That would make the moral status argument much easier, wouldn't it?
Okay, right.
We have time for one more question, and then I would encourage you to try to track down that later on.
You can beat me up later.
And prior to discussion.
We just came from the Women in Science lunch, and we said that we should ask some questions. Are we going to talk about my eggs and pecan? Where are we supposed to get them from that doesn't involve exploiting women?
Did you say exploiting? I agree, it's a problem, and I'm on the record in the President's Council deliberations saying that I'm personally against any project for my alternate cancer project that specifically superovulates a woman to get the eggs, because I think it's medically dangerous. I think it's contraindicated as an experimental procedure for an experimental project. If it were a matter of saving the life of her child, and it was clearly proven technology, that might change the moral equation a little bit. And maybe one could argue that it's justified in the face of hopeful prospects. But at this stage, the way I'm hoping they'll be able to get eggs, and I think this will happen, is to learn how to use the thousands upon thousands of immature eggs that are thrown away from infertility clinics every year. At Stanford, for example, they, you know, roughly when you superovulate a woman, you get about 12 to 15 eggs. Only half of them will fertilize. But if you take the ones that won't fertilize and you inject a sperm, 15 or 20% of those will actually grow. And those would be probably, theoretically at least, perfectly good for nuclear transfer procedures. And we will learn how to coax them into being a little more mature. Plus, there's possibilities of getting eggs from cultured follicles from ovaries, cadaveric ovaries or atherooferectomies. And as Rudy mentioned, the project of getting maybe from ES cells will eventually mature. I think there will be sources of eggs. It's a subject of a lot of inquiry, and I'm optimistic that this will be a successful project. I think they all go hand in hand. But I agree with you, there are moral issues there. Just let me make one final comment. You might be interested to know that this project that we're working on, that Rudy and I have been working on, altered nuclear transfer, has the endorsement of a very broad array of moral philosophers and religious authorities, including I have a letter from Archbishop Lebeda. I'm not Catholic by background, but somebody told me I should go talk to him, and I spent 3 hours explaining it to him. And he wrote President Bush a letter after that and said, please pay attention to this, it's a very hopeful project. He's now prefect of the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith in Rome, so the second most powerful person in the Catholic Church. So we have a hopeful project here. We really might have a way to go forward without all this controversy, and I would encourage you to find out more about this and the other methods of curing the cells without creating destroying embryos, because even if you don't agree with the moral objections, it would be better to go forward with positive pluralism.
Is there a website for the President's Council with information?
Yes, bioethics.gov, and there's also an altered nuclear transfer website, all one word, .com. Altered nuclear transfer.com.
Okay, thank you.